What I really hope is that this will signal a change in the way that wildlife is managed in the state of Alaska.
Reaction to the resignation of the state's head of wildlife conservation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 13th. Good evening. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, the Renda and the Healy make it within sight of Nome.
Just because you can see specks doesn't mean they're going to all of a sudden loom right out in front of you.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Governor Sean Parnell is not commenting on yesterday's resignation of Corey Rossi, head of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's Wildlife Conservation Division. Rossi was charged Thursday with 12 misdemeanor counts related to an illegal bear hunt in 2008. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
The alleged illegal hunt occurred in June 2008 on the north side of Cook Inlet. Alaska wildlife troopers say Corey Rossi aided two non-residents in killing three black bears and took one black bear himself. Troopers say Rossi then lied on state hunting reports by claiming that he killed all four bears. It's unclear what the Parnell administration knew and when. Asked by email how and when the governor's office found out about the investigation, spokeswoman Sharon Lehow declined to comment. Rossi resigned his position with Fish and Game on Thursday. A close friend of former Governor Sarah Palin's parents, he joined the department in 2009 as an assistant commissioner for abundance management, a position specially created for Rossi by the former governor. In 2010, Governor Sean Parnell and then-Commissioner Denby Lloyd tapped Rossi to lead the Division of Wildlife Conservation, demoting longtime Fish and Game employee Doug Larson. The appointment was controversial due to Rossi's advocacy of predator control programs. Current Division Operations Manager Dale Rabe has been named Rossi's interim replacement. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
The charges against Corey Rossi come at a particularly inopportune time for State Department of Fish and Game Commissioner Cora Campbell. But Campbell told reporters on her way into the Board of Game meeting this afternoon in Anchorage that the situation will not hamper the meeting. Campbell said Rossi's work for the department is appreciated.
He was the leader of the division for quite some time, and he certainly made a lot of contributions, and I do appreciate the service that he gave to the state and to the resources. He was a dedicated employee during his time at Fish and Game.
Campbell said Rossi was a staunch defender of state management rights, but otherwise did not elaborate on what those contributions were, citing a need to get back into the meeting. Other comments were not so kind in the wake of the charges against Rossi. Jim Stratton is regional director for Alaska's Division of the National Parks Conservation Association.
Well, I think that it's unfortunate that an official in state government had to break the law. What I really hope is that this will signal a change in the way that wildlife is managed in the state of Alaska.
In 2010, Rossi's hiring was protested by a number of fish and game biologists who delivered a letter to the state saying that he did not have the scientific background to do the job. John Toppenberg is executive director of the Alaska Wildlife Alliance. He says he remembers it well.
I do recall that time, and I ended up taking that document to the governor's office here in Anchorage. Well, what came of that was exactly nothing.
Toppenberg says the door is now open for changes in fish and game management practices. Predator control issues are topping this week's Board of Game agenda. Legislators have released the details of more new bills going before the legislature that convenes next week. The 28 new bills will join those left over from last year and those introduced last week. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
The latest bundle of bills made public has measures ranging from one by Dillingham's Bryce Edgman that would allow fishermen to borrow up to $200,000 to purchase commercial fishing entry permits, to another by Fairbanks' Joe Thomas, creating a loan program for consumers to convert their homes to natural gas-fired heating systems. That comes as Rail Belt residents begin to see a natural gas pipeline in their future. Thomas also wants to provide 10 years of rent-free state land for high-capacity gas storage facilities. Anchorage Democrat Berta Gardner has proposed two bills in the House requiring oil and gas companies to tell the public what they did to earn any state tax credits. Gardner says people have asked what the state's gotten in return for more than $3 billion in investments since the current tax regime went into effect.
I don't know. But I think Alaskans should know, just like every penny that comes through my office or that I spend on travel or whatever is publicly available. I mean, the industry, of course, likes to keep their affairs private. Of course they do. But I'm not saying shame on them for that. I'm saying shame on us.
Gardner isn't looking for expense details. Her bill mandating labor reports for credits claimed would only require release of workforce numbers, not individuals or their exact duties. Democrats Les Guerra and David Guttenberg have a bill that would reduce student loans by 2% while students work in the state after graduation. Guerra said something's wrong when student loans are double the cost of a used car loan. And Anchorage Republican Bob Lynn wants to require health insurance for retired state employees to cover the cost of colorectal screening. He says the cost of treatment would be lower because any cancer caught early is less expensive to treat. These new bills will formally be read into the record Tuesday afternoon when the House and Senate begin their 90-day sessions. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
After stalling and delays last month, TransCanada and ExxonMobil have filed draft resource reports on their proposed Alaska natural gas pipeline to the lower 48. Prospects for the pipeline have been looking grim after Governor Parnell encouraged gas producers to focus on a liquefied natural gas project in Alaska, and TransCanada and Exxon skipped filing their draft reports by last month's original deadline. But today, the companies took the next step in advancing the project by turning in the resource reports. The federal pipeline coordinator charged with working on a project, Larry Persily, says it's a welcome development.
Well, they're a couple weeks later than people had expected or hoped for, but it's good news that they're filed. It means, at least for now, the TransCanada Exxon Mobil venture is continuing through the regulatory process toward its October application to FERC for a certificate to build and operate the project. Doesn't mean they're going to build it, but it's another step, and it's a positive step.
The 11 resource reports are the culmination of work that took 3 years and millions of dollars. They're now with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. They provide data on the 800-mile corridor the gas line would take from Point Thompson through Alaska to the Canadian border. The 4,500 pages detail the project's potential impact on the land, bodies of water, communities, wildlife and fish, and other resources along the pipeline's expected path. Persily says they're chock-full of valuable information.
Even if this thing never got built, there's a lot of good data there for state and federal agencies, for communities and the rest. But assuming you're working toward building a project, the whole purpose of this is for everyone to look at it and say, hey, here's some gaps. You're missing some things. I don't have the information I need. Go out and get that before you submit your final reports and complete application in October for the project. And then that becomes the basis for the environmental impact statement.
In another sign, a project is a long way off, however. The Office of the Federal Pipeline Coordinator took a hit last month when Congress slashed its budget from $4 million to $1 million. Persily laid off four of his Washington-based staffers this week, leaving two in the Washington office and five in Anchorage. He's also moving the D.C. office to a significantly smaller and cheaper location. President Obama announced today a plan to shake up and streamline federal departments and agencies. As part of that, he wants to move the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, from under the Commerce Department to the Interior Department. NOAA includes fisheries and has a huge impact on Alaska's fish stocks and jobs. Jeff Zienitz, Deputy Director for the Office of Management and Budget, says there aren't yet details of exactly how NOAA would look after the proposed move.
The whole of NOAA moves to the Interior Department. How we appropriately integrate so that we're achieving efficiency and making sure that we are achieving the mission of NOAA in the context of the Interior Department will be worked out as part of the details of the specific proposal.
NOAA makes up more than 50% of the Commerce Department's budget. Fisheries and oceans advocates have long complained that NOAA was an odd fit under Commerce, but there's less agreement about what exactly to do with it. The White House plan was met with skepticism by Senator Mark Begich, even though he's a member of the president's Democratic Party. In a statement, Begich said NOAA will be buried in the Interior Department, which he called already overburdened. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, forecasting the sea ice for the Bering Sea crab fleet.
In the winter months, if my husband picks up the phone and hears, he goes, it's a boat. He answers to me.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
The Renda and Healy appeared offshore last night, but Nome residents are still waiting for the delivery of their fuel. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
All morning and afternoon, Nome residents were waiting for the two specks on the horizon to get bigger, signaling movement of the 1.3 million gallons of fuel towards the city. The Coast Guard cutter Healy and Russian tanker Renda had remained roughly 7 miles offshore of Nome, where they parked late last night. Finally, around 1:30 this afternoon, those closely watching the ships sent some progress. No agency, the Coast Guard or Vitus Marine, is willing to put an arrival time on the Renda. Marine pilot Captain Rick Entman has been in communication with the Healy and Renda for the past few days. He says stubborn shore-fast ice has been difficult for the vessels today.
Just because you can see specks doesn't mean they're going to all of a sudden loom right out in front of you. They are dealing with Mother Nature and the ice, I'm trying to be so careful at this time.
And in being careful, Entman says traversing to Nome doesn't mean simply going from point A to point B.
It's a series of zigzags and forward two steps, back one, forward one step, back three, you know, let's try this, let's try that. But everybody up there is working really hard.
Moving towards the final and most challenging mile, there are still questions about whether the Renda will take the lead position for the last stretch in. Coast Guard Commander Scott Johnson is the operations section chief for Forward Operating Base Nome.
We're not sure that's going to happen exactly. There are several plans in place here. There's many tools that the captain on the Healy and the personnel on the Renda, the captain on the Renda, have at their discretion. And we're not certain whether the Renda is going to take the lead or not at this point, but that will be worked out by them.
Earlier plans called for the Renda to move in front as the water becomes too shallow for the Healy. The Healy has had to directly assist the Renda throughout the 300 miles of ice, and the Healy's ice-breaking power could ultimately be critical in getting the Renda out. Ice experts have identified several specific thick pressure ridges that would work for mooring of the Renda. Even with the vessels in sight, no one is committing to a specific ridge or position. As the Renda will very quickly become frozen in the ice, planners must ensure that the Renda can get out after 36 or 48 hours or more of fueling operations. The Healy, however, can only come to within a half mile of the harbor entrance due to her 29-foot draft. Johnson says a balance is what they're ultimately hoping for.
Closer is better, but we want to balance the safety perspective with how close they come in. So there are several tools available to them. We're going to try to get a nice, good mooring for Dorenda and a stable mooring, and hopefully she'll get in close enough to one of those ridges where things will work out fine for laying out the hose.
And as for today's labored efforts from 7 nautical miles out, Johnson says things are indeed moving slowly in the final miles, but they are hopeful on making the ultimate mooring today.
By end of day today, we'll be ready, very happy to have the Renda moored up and in position, and be ready soon thereafterwards to start to work the ice and prepare the ice to run out the hose to her.
A 12-hour period will be necessary to freeze the Renda into place. The mission's delivery plans, as approved by the state, require that the initial fueling operations begin during daylight hours. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
So far this year, most parts of the Arctic have seen less sea ice than normal, but not in the Bering Sea. Persistent cold weather has brought the ice edge to within 40 miles of the Pribilof Islands. That's a concern for fishermen heading north for the snow crab season. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
Kathleen Cole is the sea ice program leader with the National Weather Service in Anchorage. She says the ice came in early and quickly this year.
It's been a fast onset of the ice in the Bering Sea, probably 2 to 3 weeks ahead of what would be normal.
That cut short the St. Matthew blue king crab season. Crabbers left 20% of this year's quota unharvested after sea ice covered the fishing grounds. And it's looking likely that ice will interfere with the snow crab season as well. Snow crab is the largest crab fishery by volume, and the allowable harvest almost doubled this year to 89 million pounds. The rules say nearly half of that crab, 42 million pounds, has to be delivered to processors north of 56 degrees. In practice, that means most of it will go to the Trident processing plant on St. Paul Island in the Pribilofs. So long, of course, as crabbers can get to it, which they can't do if the island is surrounded by ice. And Cole says she's confident the ice will get there at some point, although when it will happen and how long it will stay is harder to predict.
The Bering Sea is tricky because the ice will come down and it'll stay in an area maybe 30 to 40 miles north of the Pribilofs, and it'll stay there and stay there and stay there, and then all of a sudden you'll get an early March storm and it'll just flow right down to St. George in a matter of days. And so then that would be the maximum extent. And then that storm goes past and the ice starts moving back north again.
That uncertainty is keeping everyone in the industry vigilant. Crabber Jeff Morehouse says he's been keeping an eye on the forecast as he gears up to head north.
That's the big thing. That'll change everything. Hopefully it'll just go smooth and the southerlies will come and it'll be like last year, but I don't think that's going to happen.
If St. Paul is cut off for an extended period of time, it could affect the length of the season and even the price of crab. The fishery is technically open until late May, but most years boats finish up by early April, which is good timing according to Jake Jacobson, executive director of the largest crabber cooperative, ICE. He says the Canadian crab fisheries open in April and the supply end of the market gets flooded. Right now, the price is expected to be around $2 per pound, but if the season ends up overlapping with Canadian crab, that could change. But so could the weather. Cole says warm air moving up from the south will probably push the ice edge back at least a little bit in coming days. And who knows, maybe more warm weather will follow. But in all the uncertainty, Cole says one thing is for sure. She'll be getting a lot of phone calls as the season progresses.
In the winter months, if my husband picks up the phone and hears, he goes, "It's a boat." He answered to me.
Reporting in Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD. Also, paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
K Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Casey Kelly. Today on AK, a tropical oasis. It's been a particularly cold and snowy winter for much of Alaska, and in the middle of January, it's hard to find a warm, soothing, plant-filled haven complete with singing birds and blooming tropical plants unless you fly to Hawaii. But we dug into the AK archives for a story about a secret hotspot in Anchorage. APRN's Lori Townsend is willing to share. Sort of.
I get really tired of scraping the windshield every single morning. Ugh. Winter has lost its pristine white appeal by now and is just a grind. Unfortunately, this winter burnout always hits when I have no money to travel someplace warm, which is pretty much every year. So I start making regular trips to the only oasis I know of in Anchorage, and it's free. Ah, the tropical greenhouse, aviary, and solarium is a treat of warm, humid, flower-scented air. A delightful place to spend time strolling and gazing at lush, blooming vegetation, birds, and ponds with fish. A place for reading, writing, or having lunch, as the young couple carrying a cloth-covered wicker basket I encounter on a recent trip had just finished doing.
It's really nice, especially in the winter, because you can just, you know, relax and it's warm and kind of pretend that it's not cold and snowy. My sister comes in here and draws, sketches, and he'd never been here before, so it surprised him.
Yeah, and can I talk to you for a minute?
Sure.
And so this is your first trip?
Yeah, this is my first trip. I'm very glad that I came here. It was a very nice surprise. We've been trying to figure out the place for lunch where to go. And then she said, well, I know a really great place. And when I stepped in, I was like, whoa, that is the best I could ever imagine. Very nice.
The facility was built in 1964 for the purpose of giving Anchorageites, desperate for light and living things in below-zero conditions, a reprieve. Mary Susan Goosey is the horticulture supervisor for the municipality. She says the tropical greenhouse has varieties of plants that are decades old.
I think some of the plants have been here probably since 1964. A lot of the plants, we take them and root prune them back and try to keep them in the smaller pots just so we can contain them in this area. Like the Norfolk pine, it tries to grow through the ceiling.
Goosey's been with the facility for more than 20 years, starting as a seasonal planter, gradually working her way up to oversee the 10 year-round employees and 45 seasonal workers tasked with the annual planting of 85,000 flowers around the city. The air is particularly sweet because they use no chemical pesticides, just nice bugs that eat bad bugs. The moisture is heaven to winter-weathered skin and lots of water-loving plants.
That's Spanish moss. It's hanging all over. It grows from the moisture in the air. And the pools or ponds, they create moisture in here too.
Goosey says although someone comes to spend their lunch break nearly every day, it's still relatively unknown.
And it's probably one of the hidden secrets. I know we hear a lot. Well, we didn't know you were there, and we've lived here for 20 years. And so if you haven't been to the greenhouse, I'll give you the address. It's 1321 Woodward Springs. Wonderful place.
Oh, that's too bad. Those naughty birds are so loud. I guess I'll have to keep my hotspot a secret just a bit longer. Sitting in lush, tropical surroundings alone and guilt-free, I'm Lori Townsend.
And now it's time for 300 Villages. In honor of winter, we're heading to one of the snowiest locations in the state, Valdez. The city has had a record amount of snow this year.
My name is John Hosey, and I am the city manager for the city of Valdez. We've got a lot of snow removal going on. We've had above record level snowfall this season. We're currently at about 27 feet for the year. That is about equal to our average total annual snowfall for Valdez. So we're used to getting a lot of snow, but this is crazy, just even for Valdez. Our all-time record snowfall was back in 89-90, and we are currently at about 50 inches above where they were at the same time in the winter. So it's a pretty extraordinary snow event for us this year. Well, actually, as far as just moving around, it's not that big a deal. We have the best road crews, street crews, I think, in the world. The biggest concern with Valdez right now are snow loads on the buildings. Even under our heavy code requirements, we have many buildings in town that are at or above the code limit. And that's our biggest issue. And what is affecting us mostly this week is that our school buildings have reached that limit. So we've had to close schools, and we're organizing a massive effort to try and get people up on roofs to shovel. We don't want to divert resources from somewhere else until we're sure we've exhausted our own. And frankly, Valdez prides itself on being the snow capital of the world, and we wanted to give this a college try and make sure we could do it ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean we might not declare an emergency. We're making our best effort at it, and if it were to continue to snow, or if we cannot get ahead of the rate for clearing snow off of buildings, we may still need to ask for help. Fortunately, Weather Service is saying that we're going to have a little break here. We're getting a little bit more snow today, but then we're hoping it's going to clear out for the weekend, and we're hearing it might stay clear through middle of next week. So we're really looking forward to getting a break and trying to get ahead of this.
That was John Hosey, city manager for Valdez. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Annie Fite and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for some tunes from a singer-songwriter who finds much of his inspiration in Alaska. I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Juneau, Ben Matheson, Lorelei Kanin, and Matthew Smith in Nome, and Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the statewide BP Teachers of Excellence Program. Nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Nominations are due by February 14th.
Every Alaskan can make a difference when we file online for our PFD. You can shelter families in crisis, nourish the hungry and homeless, and protect those who have suffered abuse and neglect. And it's easy to share a little of your PFD through Pick, Click, Give. And good things will happen for the causes you care about. This message sponsored by Atwood Foundation and Alaska Children's Trust.
You can find APRN headlines from around the state online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. AlaskaPublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.